I talked to some of these students and stuff, and they were wondering, I'm a classwork, but besides that, the page for the informatics work, but it's kind of old.
I'm updating it still.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, because it was a tutorial.
You should have received an email.
Today?
No, a few days ago, I think. Okay. Somebody emailed around about all the tutorial groups.
Okay.
But what I'll do is maybe if there are people who've joined the group. Some people might have joined the class since that email went round. So what I'll do is, after the lecture, I'll email around about all the tutorial groups next week.
All right, cool.
Okay, before we start the lecture itself, hello, can I have your attention, please? So before we start the lecture itself, I'd like to check, did all of you receive an email from one of the ITO staff about which tutorial you've been allocated to? I see some nods. Is there anybody here who didn't receive that email? I see a few hands. Okay. What might have happened is, I know in the first week or two, people are kind of shuffling around courses. It may be kind of question exactly when the email went round. It went round before all of you actually signed up. But what I'll do is I'll make sure after lecture that another email goes round to everybody who's currently registered for the course, just reminding you where the web page is that lists all the tutorials, and you'll be able to find yourself in whichever tutorial group you've been allocated to. Now, I've seen a few cases because people have been chopping and changing. You might find yourself listed in more than one group. In that case, for right now, just pick a group and go to it. If we, next week, can narrow down allocations and remove duplicates, then we'll certainly let you know which slot we've chosen to put you in, just to make sure that we keep the numbers in the groups reasonably balanced. But the tutorials will be starting next week. They will be starting next week, and the topic will be it's this first tutorial sheet. It's the same one as is last year up in the web pages, and it's all about data representation. Let's see, any other announcements? Yes. So I'll email around about this too, just to make sure I catch everybody, but there will be no lecture next Tuesday. Instead, there will be the next lecture will be this time Friday next week. So no lecture Tuesday next week. I'll be actually taking a couple of, so there are a couple of tutorial groups allocated to me on Monday and Tuesday. I'll be emailing those students in those groups about alternative times next week to meet, because I won't be able to make the Monday and Tuesday. So just to kind of give you a heads up on that. But yes, unless if you don't hear anything from me shortly, then just assume your tutorials are going ahead as scheduled next week. And yes, the class rep pointed out too, yeah, I've been rather tardy in updating the web pages. So I've got the new web page more or less ready for this year. I mean, the last year's is still, in terms of content, it's all relevant and accurate for what we've been doing so far. But I'll get the new one up there, which will have things like the times of the handouts for the lab assignments, sorry, the homework assignments, and when those will be due. And I've just been trying to shuffle things to try and arrange, make sure that the hand-in times for those labs are well away from hand-in times you've got for Informatics 2A and the Informatics 2 software engineering courses as well that many of you are taking this semester. All right, let's go on with the lecture then. So last week, on Tuesday, we were starting to look at the MIPS instruction set, and we worked through sort of a few of the basic kinds of instructions that you find in this instruction set. Today what I'd like to do is finish a review walking through some more of the kind of rest of the main classes of instructions that we find in this instruction set. So as it says there, the kind of main topic is looking at what we call control transfer instructions. All right, so control transfers, this is, you're familiar with the concept, this is kind of what happens, this is the kind of way in which we implement what happens when you do something like execute an if statement in Java. So we'll be looking at how, for example, if you were to compile Java to MIPS code, how something like an if statement like that one up there, how that would go and get translated down to MIPS code itself. So within the MIPS instruction set, what we find for helping you implement this kind of thing are what are called jump instructions and what are called branch instructions. Usually the difference between these is that with a jump instruction, typically what you're providing is an absolute address that you jump to. With a branch instruction, it's often a assigned to's complement number, which is a relative shift of the program counter. It's telling you how much forward or backwards within some usually fairly small region of program memory you're going to jump if you're going to take that branch. The most elementary of the branch instructions is this conditional branch instruction, branch BEQ, or branch if equal. So what this does is it takes the names of two registers. So remember, we've got these 32 general purpose registers. So we can name any two. And then this instruction looks at the contents of those two registers and sees whether the contents are equal or not. And if they are equal, the branch is taken. And what you do is you jump to a location given by this argument called label up here. We'll see an example of this very shortly. If the branch is not taken, then the instruction executed is the one that follows immediately after the branch of equal instruction. What already is happening in assembly code versus machine code is when we look at machine code, we don't have this concept of a label, which can be an alphanumeric name. In machine code, when we're branching, all we're providing is actual numbers saying how many locations forwards or backwards we're going to branch, or what location we're going to jump to. Obviously, to program with actual numerical locations would be incredibly tedious. So compilers for assemblers provide facilities for translating these symbolic labels into the actual numbers that you need to for the actual machine code. So let's see how this is realized. So what we're going to do is we're going to say we've got this Java code up here, and we're going to look at how that then could be realized using some MIPS assembly code. And we're going to assume that the value of I is held in a register named by this register name $S1, and J is held in location labeled by this. So probably going to be clear if we, this is going, I'm going to show you all the code and then walk through it. It's much easier to. All right, so what happens? So the program counter comes along here. Here we encounter the branch of equal instruction. So saying since S1 is I and S2 is holding J, we're saying if I is equal to J, jump to the location label 1. So now here we see when we write our instructions, we leave a column free on the left where we can put these labels. So we can use these labels to identify positions in our lists of instructions. So here what we're saying is if I is equal to J or S or register S1 is equal to register S2, then jump to, branch to the location named by label 1. So that means go over here. So here we're going to have some code corresponding to statement S2. So that corresponds to actually what we want up here, that if I is not equal to J, we want to execute statement 1. Otherwise, we want to execute statement 2. So this case here is for the case when I is equal to J. So this looks good about how we execute statement 2. And then if it turns out these things are not equal, we just drop through and we execute the code for statement 1 here. Then what we come to here is a jump instruction with just the letter J is the name of the instruction. And so this is an unconditional jump. There's no testing of whether things are equal or not. If you hit a jump instruction, you always follow it. So we're going to execute, we can come down here, we execute this jump instruction. It says jump to label 2. And so what we're now doing here is we're skipping over the code for statement. So we jumped to label 2, skipping over the code for statement 2 down here, where now we can start executing statement 3. So what you find when you look at assembly code versus more kind of block-structured Java code up here is that you have to lay out things in a very linear fashion, and you have to kind of insert these extra, as well as having something that corresponds to this if statement here, you've got to have something which kind of moves you around code that you don't want to execute. Because by default, when you're executing instructions, you just execute one instruction after the other, kind of sequentially down the list of instructions. Any questions on this? Is this translation clear?
Skip statements of if comment.
Right, so in the assembly code, comments are introduced by a pound sign or hash sign here. So anything after that is free text up to the end of the line. It can be anything. So here, just as a comment saying, by doing this jump, what we're doing is we're skipping the code, this implementing statement too. Any other questions? All right. So the next slide, what we're looking at is a bit about how these branch instructions and jump instructions are actually stored in the memory, how they're realized in machine code. So as before, all the instructions are single word 32-bit instructions. Here's what the conditional branch, the general structure of a conditional branch like BEQ looks like, that we have 6 bits up the front here for specifying what the instruction is. So there's, if we put the number 4 in these upper 6 bits, then that corresponds to the instruction code for the opcode for BEQ. We've got a pair of 5-bit fields to name the two registers that we're comparing for equality. And then we've got 16 bits here to talk about where we're going to jump to. Now, yeah, so this is just stuff I said before. So these labels are strings. And if when you calculate a label, this is how it's calculated, that if PC, so here PC is the address of the branch instruction. Branch target is the address we want to jump to. Then we've got to pick offset such that PC plus 4 times offset equals where we want to jump to. So that kind of solution of that equation is what the assembler does for you every time you use a symbolic label in a branch instruction. Now, anybody ideas why we've got a 4 there? No.
Because we have 4 there on the 6 on top.
Okay, let's think about, so remember what was I saying last week, on Tuesday, about addresses? Do addresses talk about words or do they talk about bytes?
Right?
Sorry?
Do they have to be integer length?
Do the offsets have to be integer length?
Aligned.
Oh, aligned.
Ah, 4 bytes.
Yes, So alignment is the key, that when we store instructions in memory, we always store them in an aligned fashion. So every 4-byte instruction always starts on an address which is a multiple of 4. And for that reason, when we're specifying an address to jump to, we never have to specify the last 2 bits. And so for that reason, because we know those last 2 bits are always going to be zeros. And so this times 4 is the same as taking the offset and just shifting it 2 places from each to the left and just putting in 2 zeros at the end there. Because we know whatever address we're going to jump to, at the end it's always going to have 2 zeros. So that's why we've got a times 4 there. Here's another example of instruction. That's a branch if equal. There's a branch if not equal. So here we take the branch if we find the values in the two registers are not the same as each other. Here's how, as a binary word, the jump instruction is realized. So what we have here is again a 6-bit field which holds the number 2, which says that this here is a jump instruction. And now we've got 26 bits here for saying where we want to jump to. So this slide actually doesn't give the way in which the address is calculated that we're actually jumping to. But I'll just explain it in words. So with the jump instruction, what it does is it takes the, it In this case, it works with absolute addresses rather than relative addresses. So when we talk about a relative jump, we mean something like here. We're jumping relative to our current program counter. When we say an address is absolute, we mean we just kind of take it and we use it as is. We don't add it to the current program counter. And so here what we do is we take these 26 bits. Again, we follow this trick of adding 2 bits on the zero, 2 bits on the right, because we know that we're jumping to a word address. We're jumping to an aligned address. So we can specify a 20-bit address that we can jump to. But hopefully already kind of some little alarm bells are ringing in your mind about this. You're kind of thinking, well, but we've got 32-bit addresses. We haven't got 28-bit addresses. What are we going to do for those upper 4 bits? So the decision in the MIPS architecture was that those upper 4 bits would be taken from the current program counter. So essentially what this means is that your whole entire 32-bit address space is divided up into 16 sections. And using this particular instruction, you can jump within one of those 16 sections, but you can't jump outside it. And if you want to jump outside, then you have to do something different. And in a few slides' time, we'll see an example of what you can do that is different. All right. So we've seen how you code an if statement. Well, these jump and branch instructions can also be used and are used to code loops. Here's an example. Let's consider the Java code at the top there. So we've got a while loop, very simple. We're kind of schematic. We just assume there's some statement here in the body. We don't really care about what it is and how it's translated to code, to machine code, to assembly code. But what we care about is the control structure of the loop. So we care about the fact that with a while loop, we're doing this test first, when we first start executing the loop. And then if the test turns out to be true, we execute the statement, and then we go back to do the test again. If the test turns out to be true again, we do the body again. When we come back to the test and the test is false, or maybe even at the start when the test is false, then your standard understanding of the while loop, the standard semantics of the while loop, is that you then exit the while loop and continue executing the instruction immediately after the loop. So this code here can be translated into MIPS instructions, assembly code, as following. So here, what we're going to do is we're going to assume that there's a label for the code immediately after the loop. And then this first branch instruction is going to be what we need to do in order to get out of the loop. So one thing you've got to watch when you're doing these translations often is that you're doing a reversal of the logic of the test. When you've got this while loop, what you're doing is you're doing a test for when you should stay in the loop. Now when we write the machine code, we're doing a test for when we should jump out of the loop. So the test here says when count is not equal to zero. But actually what we're doing here is we're saying when count, which is stored in register S1, is equal to zero, let's branch out and jump to the end. So we're achieving the same result, but the actual polarity of the test is opposite. So that's just something you have to watch when you're doing this coding, that you are thinking carefully about what's going on. So here we're saying, let's exit if count is equal to zero. Otherwise, we fall through the next instruction here. We execute the code corresponding to statement up here. And then after we executed that code, we do a jump back to the test of the loop. And this is an unconditional jump. So we're not doing a test here at all. We're just going back to the beginning and then doing that same test again. So that's first example of how we code a while loop. Any questions on that? Good. All right. Down below, what we've got is a tiny bit more complicated example where inside the test of the while loop, what we're doing is we're looking at 2 boolean values, flag 1, and flag two and we're saying it's got to be the truth, it's got to be the fact that both of them are true if we're going to continue executing the body of the loop. And furthermore, we're using a what's called a conditional and sometimes rather than the single ampersand symbol. Can somebody remember what the difference is between the two? Sorry? The and is bitwise. And something very special about very special about this one too is that in general, if it turns out that the first argument evaluates to false, then we know immediately that the whole and is going to be false, and we don't even look at the second result, the result of evaluating the second argument. And in this example, we actually see a realization of that semantics, of that meaning of the double ampersand and operator. So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of turn around the logic, and now when we're coding, look at conditions for exiting the loop. So we're going to say, so we're going to assume that it's a bit redundant. We're going to use 32 bit registers to represent Boolean values, and we're simply going to say that a non-zero value represents the truth, represents the value true, and a zero value represents the value false, or the truth value false. So we're going to say if S1 is false, so we assume S1 holds flag 1, we're going to say if flag 1 is false, go to end. If it's false, we exit immediately. Otherwise, we come through to the second branch instruction. Now it's checking if flag 2 is false. And if flag 2 is false, we're going to the end again. And then we only reach the statement here if both these flags are true. So this is correctly realizing what we're doing up here. So if we haven't taken both these branches, we come down here, we execute the statement, and then we do a jump back to the first loop test again. Is that making sense? All right, let's continue. All right, so testing whether things are equal or not is all very good, but often we want to do more sophisticated tests, like we want to know whether we want to branch if one number is greater or equal to another number. And in actual MIPS code, there isn't a branch instruction which allows you to do that. Instead, you have to do you have to implement the effect of a branch of less than using two primitive MIPS instructions, and this is how you do it. So firstly, we have a instruction called setIf less than. So what this does is it works with the names of three registers, R1, R2, R3, as with something like the arithmetic operations. It's an R format instruction. So this is the same format, if you remember from Tuesday, used for add instructions and subtract instructions, and these bitwise instructions. And the semantics is that it stores a result in the first argument, and then uses, kind of treats these arguments 2 and 3 as the registers whose values are examined and operated on. So here the effect is to set the value in register R1 to 1 if R2 is less than R3, otherwise R1 is set to 0. Let's see it in action. So assume, say in Java, we've got a while loop like this. And we're going to assume that S1 contains I and $S2 contains J. So here we're doing a set if less than. And what we're going to do is we're interested in whether J is less than I. So we're going to put S2 first and then S1 here. And we're going to store the result in T0. Remember these, by convention, these registers whose name begins with T are temporary registers. The use for very local parts of the code. So here we're going to use the T0 register, just to convey information between this instruction and the immediate instruction after it. So we're going to set T0 to true if i is greater than j, or j is less than I. And then, if it's the case that T0 is 0, then we're going to jump to the end. So here we've got an inversion of logic again. So up here, we want to, when I is less than j, we want to execute the statement here. So when I is not, greater than j, or j is not less than I, we want to exit. And so that's what's been coded here. We're saying when this test up here is has a result false, then we want to exit the loop. Otherwise, we want to actually go and execute the body of the loop and then jump back to the beginning and do this test again. So, yes, I mean, what you're seeing here is, again, you've got to watch very carefully the polarity of things, and sometimes the way in which you code things is kind of doing the test, doing things the opposite way to the way in which things are written in the Java code in order to achieve the desired result. Everybody with me? Any questions? All right. So, one remark. So, I think before I mentioned, on Tuesday I mentioned this concept of a pseudo-instruction. So in practice, when you're coding in MIPS, very, very often you want to do a branch if less than. And it's incredibly tedious always to say, well, I'm going to write down a set of less than and then a branch if equal or a branch if not equal. So the MIPS instruction set provides pseudo-instructions like branch if less than, branch if greater than, branch if less than or equal. You should certainly feel free to use those pseudo-instructions when you're writing your code, because they make the intent of your assembly code clearer. So you'll find shortly when you start to write some MIPS code for the first assignment, which I'll give you soon in the next few days, you'll find that it's rather difficult to read assembly code. So you really have to pay a lot of attention to how you lay the code out and how you comment it to make it readable and understandable. And one way in which you do that is by intelligently using these pseudo instructions rather than always laboriously writing out and being these primitive instructions, being very pedantic about that. There's really no need, and it doesn't help anybody. All right, let's move on to method calls. So let's assume we've got some Java code where we've got some method called foo. It's a very vanilla method here. It's taking no arguments, it's returning no results. Maybe it does something, maybe it doesn't, but then what it does do is return at the end. And then say we've got some Java code here where we're doing something, we're making a call to foo, doing something else, making another call to foo, and then doing something else again. So we've got some. Now the issue is, let's think about how we code this in machine code using jumps. So we can't, since we've got multiple calls to foo here, we can't simply compile foo here with a list of assembly code instructions where the last instruction is a plain jump instruction, because we don't know where to jump to. If we're executing foo here, then where we want to jump back to after finishing foo is just afterwards. If we're executing this foo, on the other hand, where we want to jump back to after executing it is right here. So we need a way of programming where we can jump to. We want a jump instruction where we jump to is not hardwired into the instruction itself. How do we do this? Well, so we have an instruction called jump and link. Well, actually, we've got two. The first one, which achieves the effect that I was just talking to, but a kind of programmed jump, is this one here, JR R1. It stands for jump register. And what you can do is you can specify the name of a register. And what it does then is it plucks the value of the register out and uses that as an address to jump to. So this also is an answer to a question that I asked earlier, which was, if you're using just a plain jump instruction and you want to jump between one of these 16 kind of master pages that your 32-bit address space is divided up into, how do you jump between these different pages? And the answer is, what you would do is you would load some 32-bit address into some register and then simply use this jump register instruction to actually jump to that address. And that would then give you the freedom to jump to anywhere in the whole 32-bit address space. But here we're going to use it for something different. We're going to use it to program where we return to after we've executed the method, so we go back to the right place. And so we're going to use this jump return instruction in conjunction with also using another instruction called jump and link. And what this does is it makes use of a particular one of the 32 general purpose registers, a particular register called RA. And what will happen is, this is called jump and link instruction, and what it does is it sets the program counter to the label, to where we want to jump to, bringing in these top four bits from the program counter. But in addition, what it does is it saves the address of the following instruction, so PC plus 4. Remember, PC is where our jump instruction is. Plus 4 takes us on to the address of the next word, so the address of the next instruction immediately afterwards. So what we're doing is saving into register RA where we're jumping from, or rather, the instruction after where we're jumping from. So now, going back to here, if a call of foo is implemented using a jump and link instruction, how do we want to realize, how do we want to realize this assembly code, this return instruction here? Any volunteers? So we can use a jump and link instruction when we're making the call, when we're making these calls here. And so what that's doing, so when we use it here, it's saving the address immediately after foo in register RA. So when we're executing foo, when we've finished executing the body of foo, and we want to go back, we want to use this jump register instruction. But what register do we jump to? Do we pick a random register? RA. We've stored in RA where we want to go back to. So let's use the jump register instruction with argument RA. And so by that technique, when we make a call, remembering the address immediately after the call, then when we're executing the function, the method that we called, we can simply do a jump and link to that register where that return address is stored in order to go back to where we should go back to. Would anybody like me to go through that again? We're kind of slowly ramping up the complexity and subtlety of what's going on here. Is this making sense? I see mostly nods. I don't see... Maybe you want to be bold and say, please, let's hear it again. Sorry? No. All right, well, this is, so we've got this set text for the course, and you'll be doing a variety of exercises as well. And set text includes a whole appendix where it walks you through the MIPS instruction set, and it's also the appendix which is linked to by the link on the first slide I showed on Tuesday. So if this is a little bit murky, go there and have a read, because it explains in the detail I've explained things here, and actually in much more detail as well, this use of the jump register instruction and the jump and link instruction. So, we looked at that. Now, this idea of when you're making a jump, storing where you want to go back to in a register, this idea works very well if you've got kind of one layer of calls to other methods. But what if you've got nested methods? So you've got a situation where you're within some code, and in that code you execute a call instruction to execute a method called A. And then within the code for A, you make a call of method B. Within the code for B, you make a call of method C. If all the time you're only using a single register, RA, to remember where to go back to, you can see things are going to get horribly confused. Because on this first call here, where we're remembering to go back to is immediately after this call here. But then we do this call here, and instead we remember where to go back to, we overwrite the instruction immediately after the call A, and we say immediately, hey, we've got to go back to here, call B, just after call B. And again, when we do this call here, where we remember to go back to is immediately after calls after the call C. And we've written over, we've kind of lost that information about where to go back to after this call B and after this one here. So we've got to do something a little bit more intelligent. And what we do is we set up a stack data structure in memory to remember a whole series of return addresses. Now, let me just double check. In first year, did you all look at the computer science concept of a stack? No. Yes, maybe. So what is a stack? A stack is a data structure. It's a data structure which is has some kind of base, and it's a series of values. Like, let's say we're just dealing with a stack of numbers. So a stack of numbers could be the numbers 4, 7, and 2. Then on a stack, we support the basic operations of pop and push. What push does, push takes as an argument, say in this case an integer, a number, and it puts a new value onto the stack. So if we executed a push of 3, for example, then what that would do would be to add the number 3 to the top of the stack. What the pop instruction does is take a value off the stack. So it's a function or method which takes no arguments but returns a result. And so if we had a stack like this and we executed a pop, we get back number 3, and then the stack would look like that, with 2 on the top. If we do a pop again, we get back number 2, and we'd have 7 on top. Is this ringing any bells? Did some of you see this? No? Yes? I see one nod, so maybe it was a lecture before a homework deadline or something. Anyway, so this is the concept of a stack. So it's an example of what we call an abstract data type in computer science. So it's, you don't find, you kind of implement stacks in various ways. And actually, there are many different ways in which you can implement a stack. You can implement one using an array. You can implement them using what are called linked lists. A linked list, something you did? Not yet. Okay, so somebody can see in the future. That's good. So that phrase will mean nothing to you, but that's another way of implementing a stack. So you got the concept of a stack here, hopefully, and the idea of pushing and popping things. So what we do is we use a stack. We implement in assembly code a stack data structure to remember successive places that we should go back to. So sometimes these stacks, too, they go by the name of LIFOs, L-I-F-O. This stands for last in, first out. And a kind of sister data structure is called a FIFO, which you should immediately guess stands for first in, first out. So a FIFO is often what we call a queue. When we are naming abstract data types, it's a queue. You put in things, put data in one end, and you pull things out the other end. So this is a stack, which or a LIFO. Let's just call them stacks. We'll see now how a stack is realized in, we'll see a stack abstractly realized. So what we're going to use a stack to save these return addresses. Because generally, we want to use a stack because generally the last return address we saved is the first one we want to use when we're doing a return. That's why the stack is the right data structure to use here. So what we're going to do is we're going to, in this case, so forever in computer science, stacks sometimes grow upwards or sometimes grow downwards, which is horribly confusing. So always when you're looking at stacks and looking at presentations of stacks, you just have to reorient yourself to kind of check which one's being used. So here, for example, we have got a stack which grows downwards. So you have to kind of turn yourself upside down and understand that the top of the stack here is down the bottom here. So what we're going to do is, as we make these calls, we're going to have the return addresses stored in this register RA. But then we'll have code immediately afterwards that pushes that value in RA out to this stack data structure. And so after we've done the call of procedure A, we're going to store in the stack where we should go back to immediately after A. And that will be the value here. And when we make the call B, we'll push out where we should go back to after B. When we make the call of C, we'll push on where we've got to go back to after C. So that when we want to then return, what we do is we just look at the top of the stack and we pop the return address off the top of the stack. So the first time we do return, when we're down here, we return to the address immediately after C. We execute some more code, and then we return to the address immediately after the call B, and so on. Here's how we might realize these push and pop operations within MIPS assembly code. So what we're going to have, we're going to assume that there's some register, we'll call it $SP, it could be any of these 32-bit, any of these 32 registers that we have. I think it's actually one even called SP, which is traditionally used for the purpose of maintaining this stack of return values. So what we're going to do is, let's see, we're going to have the assumption that SP always points to the, it always tells us the location of the top of the stack. So there's always a decision you have to make. If you've got a stack like that, is the top of the stack here, or is it kind of the empty cell which is immediately above the stack? Sometimes people use both design options. Here we're assuming that the stack pointer points to points to the top of the stack, so it kind of tells us the last used cell on the stack. So when we want to put a new value onto the stack, what we're going to do here is decrement the value of stack pointer by 4. So as I said, we're Here we've got our stacks growing downwards in the address space. We'll move the stack pointer downwards, and then we'll do a store into the address pointed to by stack pointer of the value in this register RA. This is the register, remember, where we store the address that we want to jump back to when we do one of these jump and link instructions. And then when we want to pull, we want to kind of jump back to the top of the stack, what we'll do is we'll pull that last saved address back off the stack into the this register RA, and then we'll increment the stack pointer by 4. So we take stack pointer, add 4, store it back into the stack pointer, and do that increment using this add immediate instruction. So here what we're seeing is a realization of the stack concept to save single 32-bit words, which are addresses that you should go back to. And by using the stack, we're kind of keeping in the right order the different return addresses that we need to remember when we've got nested calls of different methods. And the beauty of this kind of the use of the stack and its nesting is that we might not just have a nesting of calls like that, but we might be having kind of a call of B, a call of method B, and then we might be calling a method D. We might even have recursive methods, so methods which call themselves. You've seen recursion in the functional programming course, if you haven't seen it in the Java course. So with recursion, you definitely need stacks to kind of save the return addresses that you need to go back to. Any questions on this? Yes? It's undefined. So it all depends on the way in which things have been implemented. If you coded a stack using an array in Java and you try to pop an empty stack, you probably get some kind of exception. In general, trying to pop an empty stack would have been error. Often, sometimes you have extra stack-related methods in addition to pop and push, which allow you to test whether a stack is empty or not. So you might test the stack is empty, and if so, go off and print some error message saying, look, I found an empty stack. I didn't expect this. Please check your code. Or you might do something else. Any other questions? All right, the last slide of today. This is kind of looking forwards to kind of, or looking more generally about how we use this program stack. So what we've seen is the use of a stack data structure just to hold return values of methods. In practice, we also use what's called the program stack to hold other information about method calls, which is very useful to save. So very often, so at the top there, we kind of talk about saving registers. So when you code a method in assembly code, you want to use the temporary registers for the most frequently used variables in that method. But you can imagine kind of quickly when you've got hundreds of different methods, kind of each one wants to use a good subset of the available registers in the CPU. So very quickly you're going to run out of registers. So what you have to do is when you are making a method call, what you have to do is save those temporary registers that you once saved at the time of the call so that when you go back to just after that call, you can have those values restored, but then also whoever you make the call to can then reuse those registers for their own purposes. So what we, for example, allow is, well, we have got kind of two ways of doing this. We can say we can adopt a caller save or callee save convention. We could say that the person making the call has to save those registers that they want to use afterwards. Or we could say, well, when you're writing a compiler or compiling code, it's the responsibility of whoever's called as the first thing they do. If they want to reuse registers, then they've got to save the ones that are already there, because maybe they're holding important values that the calling program actually wants to make use of again when you go back to the calling program. So this is one other use of a stack. So now we've got a stack holding temporary values of registers as well as return addresses. And you kind of bunch those together into a storing essentially the data of a whole object onto a stack rather than just a single number. You can also use the stack sometimes to pass and return values from methods. So typically within MIPS, what we do is we allow a few of the registers within the processor to be designated as special registers for use for arguments and return values. So if I'm in one method, in the code for one method, and I'm calling another method, and all that other method wants is a single integer, then what I can do is put it into, say, register A0, and then the method I'm calling can then pick up that value, pick up that argument from register A0. So we allow up to five 32-bit words. So this is a classic error. So if you've got 0 to 4, of course, is 5. So this should be 5 here. So we can pass up to... I can't remember that. I'm not sure whether the typo is that or that, but obviously one of those is a typo. So we can pass either 4 or 5 arguments in, and also when the method's returning back, we can get up to two 32-bit words back just in the register.